I'm talking about myself, and I happen to be an expert on myself. So I'm going to start by just taking a couple of deep breaths, if anybody wants to join me. Thanks for asking me to be here tonight. Welcome to anyone who's new, and happy birthday, Randy, and congratulations on the token takers, and thanks, Noelle. My sobriety date is October 20th, 2002. My home group is Claremont Women's Step Study. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor, and I sponsor women who sponsor women who sponsor women. I grew up in a family affected by alcoholism. Neither of my parents drank because they were both raised by alcoholics. But should they ever pick up a drink, they would certainly earn a seat in this room. My family growing up was very chaotic and violent. And as someone who also feels like I was born this way, I always grew up feeling other. Different than everybody else. Highly sensitive, grandiose, childish, all the things that it talks about in the book. And felt very separate. I remember many times growing up, I would dig through my mom's dresser where she had all of her secret things, looking for the proof that I was adopted. Because I was so convinced that I did not fit into this family. And unfortunately, I never found those documents. And I do look just like my dad, so there you have it. But I always struggled with fitting in. I struggled to fit in my family. I struggled to fit in school. Everywhere I went, I just felt I suffered from that 100 forms of fear my whole life. And the way that I worked on that as a child was to seek out people who would like me. So I was always that kid who went early to school and would ask her teacher if I could help her staple papers or use the mimeograph machine, for those of you who remember that. Yeah, the smell. And wanted somebody to love me. I just wanted somebody to love me. And as time went on, I really prided myself on being a goody two-shoes. When I was in high school, I was really judgmental towards people who were drinking and who were using drugs. And I just thought, God, what a bunch of losers. Like, why are they doing that? Here I was, you know, again, trying to get people to love me by taking AP and honors classes and studying and honor roll and student government. Because I felt like if I just kept hustling for my worthiness, that people would pay attention. Of course, most of all, my parents. But really, anyone who would love me was what I was looking for. And so I never took a drink until after I was out of high school. And the first time that I drank was in Mexico, and I blacked out. And I got home, and I was terribly sick the next day, and I could not wait to do it again. I have since learned that a normal person who drinks so much that they're sick for 48 hours doesn't then think, okay, let's go again. But I did, and that started a long period of time, as I was only 18, of going to Tijuana so often. We went so often that two of my friends married bartenders there. It's no surprise to know they are both divorced. But that's how often we were down there. We were making friends and, you know, friends, and I started spending a lot of time looking for ways that men might be interested in loving me. And that was not effective either, but it didn't stop me from trying. And every time I drank, I never wanted to stop drinking, but I always tried to control my drinking because I wanted to get to that sweet spot, right? So I spent my entire drinking career chasing that sweet spot and overshooting the mark every single time. And it's like it talks about in the book, banging on the bar, like, how did this happen? How did I end up here? And so for a long time, I'm not going to lie, it was really fun. I had a great time. I was still, you know, had a job and having fun with my friends, and we would dance until 6 a.m. and then somehow I would go to work the next day, and then we'd go out and do it again, and it was fun for a while. And then it started to be fun with problems, because then I stopped being able to show up to work after being up all night and started having trouble paying my rent because I would spend my rent money on other things. And then pretty soon it was just problems. But it took me an embarrassingly long time to figure out that alcohol was my problem. I could point to a million things that were the reason that my life was such made of such chaos. Why my relationships were falling apart, why I couldn't keep a job, why I moved every 6 months, why my electricity bill was getting cut off. It was always about other things. You know, it was my parents' fault. It was, you know, they don't understand me at the job. That's why they're firing me, not because I couldn't show up. You know, it was always somebody else's problem. And I grew up with a mom who was a martyr and still is to this day. And I learned well that it's always on someone else. So I kept living that way, and my life kept going downhill, as you can imagine. And pretty soon, I started experiencing some pretty significant depression. And over time, it got worse and worse. And I wasn't able to have fun anymore at all. And there came a series of events where I had promised myself that I was not going to drink more than 3 drinks. Because I still, you know, all these years in, that was my sweet spot. If I just can drink 3 drinks, then I can have a good time and I'll still feel okay and I can talk to people. And then lo and behold, of course, every single time I overshot that mark. And after a series of those events came a time where I was sitting in my bathtub planning to kill myself on October 20th of 2002. And I was sitting there and I was crying, and I'll never forget that day, that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, that another night had passed where I wasn't able to control and manage my drinking, when as soon as I took that first drink, that it was just off to the races. And I was sitting there, and then I was starting to waver that maybe I couldn't really kill myself. So then, of course, I start beating up on myself more because now I'm just too weak to even do that. And I can tell you now that it was a higher power, because something happened that I had no control over, and I picked up my telephone, don't remember doing it, and all I remember was I called my father, and I said, I need help. Now, my dad is the last person that I would call for help. The only thing my father knows about Alcoholics Anonymous is what he learned on NYPD Blue. But he knew enough to tell me, I want you to pack a bag, and I want you to go to a meeting, and then I want you to come over. And I went to my therapist, who told me that I needed to go to a meeting, and I, at that point, trusted her. I had been seeing her for many years, but had never told her about my drinking because that wasn't my problem. And she suggested I go to a meeting, and I went to a meeting, and I came back to see her a few days later, and I said, that place is not for me. Every other word they said was God, and I can't do that. That's not for me. And she said, well, you promised me you'd go to 6 meetings, so I guess tough shit. And so I kept going. And I feel like the second meeting, people didn't say God every other word. Now, that probably didn't change. It was that my perception shifted just a little bit. And so I stayed with my parents at that time for 2 weeks. And at the time, they lived across the street from the Serenity Shop. I couldn't go to rehab or anything like that. I had lost my job. I was on the verge of being homeless. And so luckily, they have a lot of meetings right across the street. And I just went to meetings all day. All day, every day for those first 2 weeks. And where I was living at the time was this little complex of these little cottages in North Park. It was like these tiny little one-bedroom cottages. And it was like a party complex. We had an open door policy that you can go in and take whoever alcohol or other substances that you wanted. It was just, you know, of course I thought it was the greatest place ever to live. But then once I got sober, I just wasn't sure what to do. And so that was really hard because I had to go back and to tell all these people who I would have told you with heartfelt emotion that these were my closest friends. And when I went back and told them that I was sober and that I'd been sober for 2 weeks, they didn't really want to have anything to do with me anymore. So here I was, newly sober, without any friends, and feeling a lot of hopelessness, feeling like I didn't have a solution anymore because alcohol had become my solution, and I didn't have any other option. So because I was as desperate as a drowning man seeking a life preserver, I jumped into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got a sponsor right away. She asked me if I was willing to go to any lengths to stay sober, and I had no idea what that meant. I had like 5 days sober, but I'm a people pleaser to the core, and I could tell that the answer was supposed to be yes. So I said yes, hoping that nothing completely outrageous would be involved. And I will tell you that that woman took me through the steps. She had me call her every day. And the first time that I worked the steps to the very best of my ability, it was helpful and it gave me some semblance of relief. But that woman, who is now today, these years later, my best friend, she didn't have that much sobriety and she didn't have a higher power. And so that made things a little bit difficult. I didn't have a higher power. She didn't have a higher power, trying to talk me through the steps with a lot of my resistance. And so, you know, God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. And she got pregnant and told me that she didn't think she had enough time for me because I was needy newcomer. And I moved on to another sponsor who did have a higher power and had a story that really blew my mind and had changed her life so dramatically. And when that woman took me through the steps, my life changed. I worked a fourth and a fifth step with her that was the time that I really shared those deep, dark secrets, those things that I was going to take to my grave. And I, because this woman had gone much further down the path than I had, there wasn't a fear that I was going to shock her or scare her. And it was incredibly helpful to me to be able to call her and tell her these completely crazy things that I had done before I was sober and in early sobriety, and have her say, "Yes, I understand. I've done that too. I don't think God wants you to do that." And it was incredibly helpful to me. One of the things that she taught me in working that fourth and fifth step, we finished that fifth step. It was so long that her poor husband was in the back room, and every couple of hours he would come out and say, "Are you guys done yet?" "Nope, not yet." A couple hours, "Are you guys done yet?" "Not yet." It was a novel that I wrote. And sharing that with her, I remember still to this day, you know, that was 14 years ago, driving away from her house, and I felt like the sun was shining brighter than it ever had, that I could see more clearly, and that I was not a terrible person. She would tell me all the time, "Honey, you are a good woman with a bad disease." And after we worked that fourth and fifth step, she had me start doing some things that were really uncomfortable. She said, "I want you to make a list of 10 things that you love about yourself." And let me tell you, I came up with 3. One of them was that I was a good cat mom. I mean, I fed them, so yeah. And she sat down with me, and I remember sitting down on her couch, and she said, "We've known each other for about a year and a half. I'm going to help you finish that list." And it was the first time in my life that I had sat next to someone who loved me unconditionally and who could tell me 7 things about myself. And let me tell you, I did not believe her. Not a single one of those. I argued, and she just kept telling me to shut up. She would say, I lovingly am asking you to shut up. And I listened to those things. And then she made me write them down on pieces of paper and hang them up around my house. Oh, good God. And then I had to say them out loud to myself every time I walked past one of them. And I did that for years, rolling my eyes. And then one day, I stood there and I said, I am an intelligent woman. Huh. I am beautiful. And that's not something that comes out of the big book. That's not part of the step work. But what I can tell you as a hope-to-die alcoholic is that my self-esteem when I got here was subterranean. I hated myself. And that gift that woman gave me to teach me how to love myself transformed my life. I walked through the rest of the steps with her, and then we did them again. I just wanted to continue uncovering, discovering, and discarding those things that stood in the way of the sunlight of my spirit. And throughout this time, this was years, 4 or 5 years into my sobriety, I was still really pissed that y'all were talking about God all the time, because I did not have a belief in a higher power. She would tell me to look for the coincidences and notice those, and I would say, yeah, I saw the coincidence. Yes, I saw that I couldn't pay rent and then that check I wasn't expecting came, or I saw that I, you know, didn't think I was ever going to be able to make amends to that person, and then I ran into them in another state at a random event. I see those things are happening. That doesn't prove anything to me. And shortly after that, I changed sponsors because that woman went on to have 2 more children. And I was still pretty needy, even at 4 years of sobriety. And so I got a woman who was 79, who could not have a child. So that I could get all of the attention that I needed. And what drew me to her, what drew me to that woman was that she had, you know, she had been sober as long as I had been alive, that she had a higher power, that she had a strong meditation practice, and that she was married to a man who she just adored and who thought the sun rose and set on her. And I was single and suffering being single at that time, because I'm sorry, dating is hard, and dating sober is really hard. And so her and I did some work together. And then shortly after this time, we did some work together, and then I decided I was going to do something totally outside of my comfort zone, and that was to go on a silent retreat. Now, I'm someone who likes to talk. I get paid to talk for a living. My report card's my entire life. Will not stop her incessant talking. So the idea that I was going to go somewhere for several days and not say anything was an insane proposition to me. And even my sponsor, who was this deeply spiritual woman who had been sober all these years and done all sorts of retreats, said, I think this is a little crazy. Mm-hmm. And I went, and while I was there, I did some writing, and I was sitting on the back patio doing some writing, and then I put together this little ritual that I was going to burn some of this writing that I had done. And I was sitting out on that back patio, and then all of a sudden, all of these white butterflies just were surrounding the whole patio, and something happened. And in that moment, I had the awareness that there was a power greater than myself that was conspiring in my favor and that had my best interests at heart. And that feeling has not gone away since. The rest of that weekend, white butterflies followed me around on every hike that I took. And to this day, white butterflies are drawn to me, and I see them, and I'm like, oh, there you are again. And what I can tell you is that developing that relationship with a higher power changed my life again in a new and different way. Because before, really, my higher power was G.O.D., a group of drunks. It was the room. I would borrow other people's higher power. For many years, I prayed, "Dear God, I don't believe in," and then would say my prayers. And I thought, well, if there's something and that's offensive, then oh well. And guess what? Like, those prayers started to be answered anyways. And so after I had that experience on that silent retreat, I experienced such a profound shift in my relationship to life, because I was able to start seeing the way that God was showing up in my life and in all of y'all's life on a daily basis. Before I got sober, I tried to go to school for many years. I would sign up with the best of intentions at the beginning of every quarter. Every semester, I would be like, this is the semester I'm going to do it. I'm not going to get loaded. I'm just going to go to school, and I'm going to finish. And then, you know, a couple weeks in, no, I just won't go today. Tomorrow I'll go. And then pretty soon, I just wasn't going at all. And once I got sober, I was able to go back to school and graduate. I was one of the older people in my class, and I always felt a lot of feelings of self-consciousness. And the day of graduation, we were getting ready to walk across, and I'm wearing my cap and gown, and I look over and I see a woman that I don't remember having classes with or anything like that. And she said, "I've got 2 years of sobriety, and I never thought I'd graduate from college." And I said, "Me too." And it was those kinds of moments that I started to notice all the time that were showing up in my life. And so I graduated from college, and then I decided I was going to go to graduate school, because that's the kind of thing that we can do here. We can have dreams. You know, I had worked the steps a number of times, and I had always done jobs where I was being of service out in the world, working in social services. And I got a master's degree in social work. And when it came time in school to choose an internship, I picked something that scared the you-know-what out of me, because I learned not to do that here. I learned to do the things that make me uncomfortable. I learned that what I resist persists, and that perhaps, given an opportunity, there might be something, a new and different experience that I could have. And so I chose an internship in hospice. And within 2 weeks, I was like, this is what I'm supposed to do with my life. That walking through fear, as has been proven to me time and time again in my sobriety, opens up doors to worlds that I didn't know existed. And I will tell you that being able to work in a job that is being of service to others on a very profound level has afforded me with continued spiritual experiences throughout that time. A couple of years ago, I got a call that said, this patient is dying, and he doesn't have any family, but he has a group of friends, and they have not left his side. And the team was kind of saying, it's kind of strange, like none of them are related to him, but they're taking turns around the clock, and someone needs to go and talk with them. And I was like, I'll do it. They're my people. In my mind, I'm like, those are my people. I guarantee you those are alcoholics from Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got there, and lo and behold, you know, I said, "Oh, how do you guys know each other?" And they said, "Oh, well, we have a social kind of club." And I said, is Bill one of the members? And I don't usually break my anonymity at work, but it was one of those exact moments where that was where I was supposed to be at that exact time. And I find that those things continue to show up for me over and over and over. About 8 years ago, I got a new sponsor because that older woman sponsor was getting a little older as time went on, and at that point, I wanted to start a family. I wanted to become a mother, and so I wanted to choose someone who was a parent and who, you know, wasn't maybe going to die on me anytime soon, because I'm a selfish alcoholic still. And the work that I did when that sponsor took me through the big book line by line, I got a new understanding of my disease. I got a new understanding of alcoholism and was able to have a new experience with the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was able to see patterns that I hadn't seen before. I was able to see ways in which my behavior diminished others. Because I found that with significant sobriety, I'm not a liar, a cheat, and a thief. Those are not the things that I do to get myself into trouble. Those are not the things that cause me that pit in my stomach. It's the little things, the little digs I make, the comments, the little side conversations. Those are the things. And so being able to look at my behavior in a new way and being able to look at how were these patterns of behavior continuing to show up in my life despite this much recovery and despite the fact that, you know, I pray every day, I meditate every day, I sponsor, and I go to meetings. I do all the things that I was suggested to do when I first got here. And even still, there was behaviors crop up. I am not rid of my character defects. And so they pop up and they create problems in my relationship. You know, it talks about in the book that we have, you know, we struggle to have a true relationship with another human being. And in my primary relationships with my husband and with my closest friends, those are the places that those patterns of behavior still show up. And that I have to do a 10-step on a daily basis. And these days, you know, as soon as something happens or I do something that's not doesn't feel right, I take care of it right away. You know, I have a good friend who says, it says made amends promptly, not immediately, which is when he's like trying to be like, you don't have to rush out and do it. But these days I do. I have that feeling. And to be honest, I got to get rid of that feeling because it is too uncomfortable. And I have a husband who goes to our sister program, and so it's wonderful that we are able to have a family grounded in the 12 steps. You know, I have a 7.5-year-old daughter who, you know, has started going to meetings when she was 2 weeks old and knows about the 12 steps, and she calls all of my sponsees her aunties, and that being raised in this program. And what I can tell you is that the longer that I stay sober, the more the road narrows and the more that things that used to be okay with me are not okay with me now. And I think that this program and sponsorship in particular has given me this wonderful opportunity to practice having really healthy relationships with excellent boundaries. And finding a way to be kind and firm with the people that I'm closest to. I was usually too kind or too firm. And I've learned and still continue to learn how to be kind and firm. And I've learned that in the safety of these rooms. Because the people that my sponsor, the people that I sponsor, my longtime friends in the program, the stakes are very low. I know that my sponsor, if I handle something poorly, is not going to be like, done with you. I have some of the same friends since the day I got sober. These are long-term relationships, and I know that I can say exactly what it is that I need to say. I never forget a couple of years ago, I called my sponsor, and I had to tell her this terrible thing that someone had done to me, right? It was terrible, trust me. I can't remember what it was, but it was bad. And I called her, and I was telling her, and right, I've got this rive, this frustration and anger, and let me tell you, and blah, blah, blah. And she jumps in, and she starts trying to tell me some big book stuff. And I said, Wendy, please, I just need to tell you how messed up this is. Can we talk about the solution later? And that was a turning point in that relationship. Because it was in that moment that I was like, here is a person that I can say absolutely anything to. And that I didn't have to be a jerk about it. I didn't have to be nasty. I didn't have to like give her silent scorn. I didn't have to call up all my other people I know and be like, listen to what Wendy did. I could just tell her in that moment. And because of the privilege and joy of being able to practice these skills inside of relationships in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm able to take them outside of that. I firmly believe that the work that I'm able to do working with people who are dying is a result of the work that I've done here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Being able to have difficult conversations, being able to tell people that they're dying in a few days, I think only has come after years of listening to fifth steps and other step work and being able to lovingly and kindly but firmly say, I think you're missing your part here. Having those difficult conversations has allowed me to carry out and be of service outside of the rooms. One of the things that I still am working on a daily basis is not looking for that affirmation on the outside. And it's really hard. Every single day in my prayers, I ask God to help me feel loved just as I am and whole and to only seek that for my higher power. And every single day, struggle with it. The other day, I said to my husband, I told him something I did, and he said, oh, that's great. And I said, that's all you have? He says, well, what do you want? I'm like, I would like a parade. Like, can you do a song and dance? Tell me how impressive I am? I have a friend who says that we alcoholics, if I went to China and I had every single person in China stand in a line and everyone walk up to me and said, Lisa, you're amazing, you're the best, and they would go and every person would go and they would get to the billionth person and they would finish and I would still say, that's it. And so what I know is that even with long-term sobriety, there are still things to work on a daily basis. And I find that having a sense of humor makes it really helpful. At the beginning of the year, I decided that I wasn't going to look for affirmations elsewhere. And one of the places that I get a lot of them is at yoga. So when the teacher will often say, several times a class, oh, beautiful expression, Lisa, or, lovely, or, whatever yoga things they're saying to me. And so I decided, it's too cheesy for me to even admit. And so they would say these things, and every time, I'd get that feeling, right? Everyone in this room knows what I'm talking about, that warm feeling right here. It's like, yeah, that's it. She's affirming my personhood. And so I decided I was going to stop looking for that and that I was going to tell myself, beautiful expression, Lisa, and I was going to give myself that affirmation. And that was just, something I put out to the universe. And you know what? For 4 months, not a single teacher complimented me in class. We're talking going from two or three times a class, 4 times a week, to nothing for 4 months. And every time I would leave, I just had to laugh. I was like, all right, God, I get it. I get the message. And so it came back after those 4 months. I thought I would have probably helped to go on a little longer. And now when I get those compliments, it doesn't light me up anymore the way that it used to. I just think oh, thanks. And sometimes I don't think I notice it. So really, what has happened for me is that I continue showing up. I continue doing all the things that I did when I got sober. I don't know if it's going to a lot of meetings, meeting with my sponsor every week, meeting with sponsees every week, being of service, I don't know which of it is those things is the magic bullet. I don't know which of those things get me to have a life that's happy, joyous, and free. So I just think I need to keep doing all of them. Some people who don't understand the program will sometimes say, you still go to a lot of meetings? How many people do you sponsor? How many hours do you spend on this thing? And as I said to someone the other day, I said, let me tell you how many hours I spent a week on drinking. And Yes, I drive 20 minutes each way to go to a meeting. Guess how far I would have driven for a drink? So I don't know what it is that is the secret, so I just keep doing all of it. And what I can tell you is that it talks about in the book, it says that frequent contact with newcomers is the bright spot of our lives. And sponsorship has been a huge part of my story. I feel very blessed to have had a succession of amazing sponsors. The second sponsor that I told you about, the one who taught me to love myself, she relapsed after 17 years of sobriety. And that was 9 years ago, and she hasn't made it back. And I don't think she's going to make it back. In my work in hospice, I have patients, multiple patients a week, dying of alcoholism. This is a deadly disease, and I think it's very easy to forget when we come to meetings and we come to meetings with people who stay sober. And so after that woman relapsed, I became even more vigilant, especially in the service area of my program. And that woman was an example to me. She sponsored a mess of us. Like half of the meeting that we went to on Monday night, everybody was sponsored by this woman. And we are all now women of grace and dignity who love ourselves because of her. And so I have continued to carry on what was her legacy by being of service. And I have had the privilege and honor of sponsoring a fair number of women and one fabulous man for a long time. And I have had these are long-term relationships. I frequently love to tell people that my sponsee, the man and I, he's my longest relationship. I have been in a relationship with him longer than I've been in a relationship with my husband. And having these relationships with these women and taking them through the steps and meeting with them on a weekly basis and being able to be of service, you know. The book talks about how our phone will jingle or jangle, you know, at any time of the day or night. A newcomer may burn a mattress. Nobody's burned a mattress at my house yet, but people do call in the middle of the night. And it doesn't happen all the time anymore because most of the folks I have that I work with these days have been sober a while. But it doesn't matter how long you've been sober. Tragedy can strike, and you might need to call your sponsor at 2 in the morning. And the last time that happened, she said, "I feel so ashamed to call, but I think I might drink." And I said, "Let me get up." Got up, turned on the lights, went and sat in the living room, and I talked to her. And because that's what we do. Because that's what others did for me. If I think of the hours upon weeks and days of time that my sponsors over the years have spent time with me, listening to me, particularly when I was single and I was telling the same sob story every other week about the different guy who was basically the same but just had a different name, and how patient and loving and tolerant they all were to me. It is the very least that I can do. Being able to be the person that people come to is unfathomable to me. Before I got sober, you know, I could not be held responsible to feed a friend's cat, right? And now people invite me into their lives to be there for the most difficult times. I'm able to show up for people. I'm able to be there for people no matter what. And, you know, there are times that it's not always easy. And there are times that I have a sponsee calling and I'm watching a movie. And oh my gosh. And so I have this routine and I'm very honest about it. And the phone will ring and I'll pick it up. And I'll either answer it right away or I'll take a deep breath and I'll say, "Your primary purpose is to stay sober and help another alcoholic." And then I answer the phone. And I hope that I never forget that, because even when it is inconvenient, being of service to others is what keeps me sober. Whether they stay sober or not, it keeps me sober. And the fact of the matter is that that's why any of us are here. I think that sponsorship and service work is something that is such a the whole program is divinely inspired, right? But this piece in particular, the idea of helping another alcoholic, I have sponsees with whom I have zero in common with. Aside from being alcoholic women, we don't have anything in common. We don't have the same jobs, not the same backgrounds. We don't have the same amount of money, but we connect in the language of the heart. That there is that peace where they are able to say to me, gosh, I felt just that restless, irritable, and discontent today for no reason. And then I remembered what you told me, that I should call someone else and ask them how they are. And then everything shifted. That opportunity to get out of myself on a daily basis is, it's just the magic. It's the magic, and it works every single time. I can't imagine what my life would be like today, the life that I have today. I didn't even want a life. Before I got sober, certainly did not want children. I wanted nothing to do with them because I didn't think that I would be a good enough mom. And because that woman taught me how to love myself, I was able to meet a wonderful man and to have a daughter who is my favorite person in the entire world. And to raise her, having never seen me drink, and God willing, being raised in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. Thank you.